This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside, this week reading the classics, Hidden Meaning and Censorship in Stoker, Bronte and Shelley.
So, the reason for this episode is that Jules and I are both massive nerds.
To be honest, if you didn't get that before.
Yeah, that's the reason for the entire podcast, if we're being honest.
Yes. we needed somewhere to express ourselves.
Yeah. To give you a proper explanation for why we're doing this episode, last semester, last year, I was teaching Frankenstein as part of the course. And Frankenstein is one of these books that I have continuously gone back to. I have an incredibly, I was going to say intimate relationship with Frankenstein, but that actually sounds so bad. It sounds really wrong. But it's one of these ones that I get incredibly excited about, more than I think any other gothic text that I've read. And the more I delve into it, and every time I re-look at Frankenstein, I find so many different little bits and bobs and interpretations. And alongside that, you know, I've obviously been looking more and more into Mary Shelley's life story. And you just start to see little bits and bobs which are so, they're not invisible, but you realise actually how much more you get out of the texts when context is applied. So this is me like steamrolling Roland Barthes. Roland Barthes is like, death of the... I'm like, shut up, Roland Barthes. In this particular case, we're going to apply some context, because context actually creates even more interpretation than ever before, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, I've got a few things that I'm going to bring up as well later in the podcast, but we're starting with Frankenstein and then we're moving on to a few other both gothic and non-gothic classics. We're mostly staying in the 19th century because we're trying to keep this podcast to an hour.
Yeah.
And we keep overrunning. So if we actually branched out into everything we're interested in, you'd be here for about a week at least.
Yeah, you would. And I should also point out that I was talking to Jules about all of this, and at the same time Jules was like, Dracula.
Yes, and it is the most tenuous connection, but I still went there.
No, I thought it was really interesting. And we suddenly went, should we do an episode about this? And thus, here we are doing an episode about this. So, where to start, really? I'm just going to go ahead and start by just giving a general impression of Frankenstein. Frankenstein is a revolutionary text in a lot of ways. I mean, first of all, it's considered to be the origins of science fiction. It's considered to be the first book within that genre. And it set up, you know, it set a precedent for the genre, which still remains to this day. It's also fascinating because it has touched on questions which have been plaguing humanity for, well, as long as we've been recounting stories, which is the idea of creating, you know, an artificial life form, you know, creating life not in the usual natural, you know, fetus way, but in the using other tools available to us and building life completely on our own. You know, this has been something which has been touched on throughout humanity. We go back to the Greek legends. You could just go back to Talos, which is one of my favourite Greek myths. The myth of Talos, who was a giant automaton created by Hephaestus. And I think he protected Crete. I think he protected the islands of Crete. And he was this huge, giant bronze living machine who in the end, was brought down by Medea offering him immortality. And what really interests me about that is the fact that he was a huge automaton, and yet he hadn't realised that he was immortal already. He thought he was a man.
Yeah.
So, you know, that question of what is, you know, what is it to be human? What is it to be conscious? You know, and the consequences of bringing something to life has been at the forefront of people's minds for an incredibly long period of time. And Mary Shelley really brought that to the forefront when she wrote about Frankenstein. However, there are so many different ways that it can be interpreted. I have limited myself to three.
Yeah, because, again, we don't want to be here for an entire week.
Yeah, seriously. I've limited myself to three. So I'm going to give a little sort of rundown, and I'm sure that Jules will have many intelligent things to chip in as I'm rambling. As I'm rambling, I'm like, it's like that Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme, you know, the guy with the board with all of the strings, the conspiracy theorist one, and then Jules is just there to, you know, add context to my crazy ramblings.
Yes.
Okay, so the first one, the first interpretation of Frankenstein is obviously its most popular one, and this is certainly the one which Mary Shelley kind of presents by using the subtitle The Modern Prometheus, which is the idea of man playing God. And in it, she questions what the future will bring. She throws fear into the rapid progression of science and the moral consequences of that science. Now, of course, this is something which has been continuously on people's minds, and you get exactly the same thing nowadays, except instead of, you know, dead body parts being stitched together, it's all about artificial intelligence. It's always about the robots rising against us, etc. You know, that's the kind of fear that Mary Shelley was touching on, this idea of modern technologies coming forward. But again, you look into it a little bit deeper and you have to apply contexts for the time in order to really understand exactly why she was so afraid of this kind of medical advancement. Because, you know, now you look back and go, all right, it's a bit gross. But it's not actually, and yes, okay, it is very weird. He goes around digging up dead body parts, you know, dead, you know, he's very, very weird about the whole thing. It's very odd, but it doesn't strike fear in the same way that it would have done for the Victorian audience. And that's because we don't have the same context for what was happening in the Victorian period. So let's give you a little bit of context about some of the things which were going on. So, first of all, there was no such thing as organ transplants back in the day. And Mary Shelley in some ways predicted that. It was not a thing which was done. It wasn't possible to be done. Also, at the time, they didn't really have a context of different blood types. They didn't really understand quite how blood types worked, or blood transfusions, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, just to put a year on it for people, we're looking at the year without the summer. So we're looking at 1816. Which is pre-Victorian. This is pre, you know, the great fairs and bazaars and things in London, where people were like inventing steam and coming up with computer codes and etc. This is very, very early stuff.
Yeah. So it's worth keeping that in mind. So, very, very early stuff. But what was happening was that there were advancements taking place, particularly in the medical side of things. But those advancements came on the back of, let's just say, rather amoral or immoral acts. Which was that what was happening is that you had big universities like Edinburgh University, and, you know, the sort of the medical sciences, and they were trying to learn about medicine and they were trying to teach about medicine, and it was all going very, very well. But they had one major shortage, and that was cadavers to teach their students on. They just didn't have enough bodies. This is also because you've got to bear in mind that you have a huge Christian influence, which has really risen up again. It's become very prevalent during the period and would sort of remain so into the Victorian period, where what's happening is that once again, you have this kind of this mix between this fascination with magics and also, and this is also really important, you have a fascination with magics which ties in with science. People often think of them as being two separate things. They weren't. They followed a very similar path, because originally a lot of sciences, before we have science, we have alchemy. And so there is this very intrinsic link between them. So you have this on the one side and you have big, heavy religion on the other. So what was happening was they just didn't have enough cadavers at all, which meant that they would kind of take their bodies from wherever they could get them. If people turned up and said, here's a body for you, they wouldn't really ask questions. Now, what this meant was, for the most part, there was lots of grave robbing. But then you had people like Burke and Hare. I'm sure, because we've covered... We've talked about Burke and Hare, but I'm sure Jules can provide some context for this.
Yeah, one. I mean, going back to why they didn't have cadavers, it was actually illegal to cut up bodies unless they were someone who had died on the gallows as a criminal, or they were basically orphans who died on the streets. So it was okay to cut up children who'd basically been abandoned on the streets, apparently.
Yeah, totally cool.
That was fine. Anyone who'd had a proper Christian burial and was, you know, clearly a member of society, this was not okay. You can't really learn medicine and about the human body without doing a certain amount of dissection. And, you know, the same goes for veterinary sciences and things as well. And the reason you weren't allowed to cut up bodies is it basically ties into the Day of Judgment. And the idea that you were supposed to go into your grave and then come out of it on the Day of Judgment when the last trump sounds, whole and in one piece. Yeah.
Which really makes me laugh, because, like, they knew, they did understand how, like, decomposition worked, so I really don't understand.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, I think they're kind of thinking that God is, like, the ultimate jigsaw puzzle master, and, like, yeah, okay, you might rot, etc., but it's fine, he can put you back together as long as you go into the grave whole. But if you lose some of the pieces, well, then that's it, you're kind of screwed. You're in purgatory forever or something.
Yeah, but again, I love the fact they're like, God, you know, God is all powerful, God can do everything, but he can't let you into heaven if you don't have all of your organs in the general sort of vicinity in whatever kind of capacity.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, that was sort of the excuse given, but you have to look at the people who actually run organised religion and whether or not it might have been a case of they didn't necessarily believe that, not the people at the top, and thought that, you know, they didn't actually want to start handing more power over to science and things, which is ironic, really, because early medieval, for example, medicine and things, and scientific progression, and there was quite a lot of it in that period, was actually kind of backed by the church for a lot of it. Mm. It's until you get into areas where the church feels it ought to have sway, and then it tends to sort of squash down. So yes, as Madeline says, this leads us to Burke and Hare. Burke and Hare were two intrepid Irishmen living in the Irish Quarter of Edinburgh, which was basically a slum. They were very much... basically, the Irish living in Edinburgh at that time were not treated terribly well. We'll leave it there without going more political. And Burke and Hare started, as Madeline has said, robbing fresh graves. And then they decided that they could get even fresher corpses if they started killing people and then just delivering the bodies.
Yeah.
Knock Bones Knox, Dr. Knox of one of the Edinburgh universities, was quite happy to pay for these bodies, no questions asked. And they went on a bit of a killing spree around Edinburgh.
Yes, which, yeah, obviously had large ramifications and shocked the world, really. And the thing is, I always laugh when they say, oh, everybody was so shocked, everybody was so... And I was like, really? You were shocked? You can't have been that shocked. Because, and the other thing that always gets me is that, of course, Knox, nothing ever happened to Knox.
No. Well, I mean, I think it was plausible deniability, wasn't it? They turned up with bodies. He was allowed to pay for cadavers that were of people who had died by died on the gallows, etc. Or were otherwise effectively excommunicated. And therefore, you know, he was fine. And, you know, we still use a lot of the information, that information that they got from murdering people and then cutting them up is information that we base things on today. So, like, Grey's Anatomy, for example. The book, not the television programme.
Yeah, though the television... No, I'm joking. So this is a context during the time, is that you have medicine being mixed up with incredibly amoral things. Also worth noting is that even though Knox had plausible deniability, the fact of the matter is that Knox probably suspected, or that they were probably very conscious of the fact that some of these bodies were coming from graves or from, you know, less illicit sort of places at all. And certainly Knox kind of made it very difficult at first when initial kind of investigations into Burke and Hare were taking place, such as, you know, mutilating one of the cadaver's bodies so that it wasn't one of the cadaver's faces so that it wasn't easily recognizable, etc. So, you know, you can say plausible deniability as much as you like, but the fact of the matter is that they were probably aware that there was definitely some illegal shenanigans going on. So Mary Shelley is touching in on that. She's touching in on this idea of people doing immoral acts in the name of science without actually thinking of the consequences. Now, you could say the consequences to their mortal soul, but also the consequences of the world around them. And in some ways, Frankenstein almost becomes a bit of a metaphor for Knox, you know, saying, I'm going to pay for these bodies for the, you know, for the good of science, which is for the embetterment of everybody, which has resulted actually in people dying. So that does actually kind of, you sort of start to understand why, therefore, Frankenstein is actually so scary, and why this idea of using dead bodies and stuff like that was very frightening, because not only was it robbing the bodies of their chance to go to heaven in some regards, because Frankenstein isn't even taking one body, he's taking all bits and bobs from different bodies, but it's touching in on that idea that actually we're now walking in territory which doesn't belong to us.
Yeah, very much playing God.
Yeah. So that is the major interpretation that comes from Frankenstein. But I have two others, and I am willing to argue my corner on these ones.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so the second one is that it's just a giant homosexual metaphor.
Okay, and support that with quotes from the text.
We don't have time for that, Jules. But what I can say is that I'm not alone in interpreting it in this way. Now, this is definitely territory more along the lines of where you know, Roland Barthes starts to be a little bit more comfortable. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have its merit. And certainly I'm not the only one who has interpreted the text in this way. And you can find some excellent essays all on the subject in most, well, not in most libraries, but in libraries and online and things along those lines. Okay, so how does it work? Well, I think there's something that's got to be said about a man who sets about trying to create another perfect man for another perfect man. And what interests me in particular is Frankenstein's decision to create life, but not to create life in the context of making a child. He doesn't want to make a child. He doesn't want to create life, you know, and to allow it to grow. No. Because actually there would be a very easy way for him to do that, which would be to just to actually marry Elizabeth. Now, he seems to sort of reject Elizabeth a lot of the way. He becomes very obsessed with this notion of the perfect man. And so not a child. He's not creating life in the sense of creating a child. He wants to build the perfect man. He wants to build this perfect man out of all of the perfect parts that he can get. He doesn't want to create life. He wants to literally build it in the image that he wishes. He's also not creating life in the sense of thinking of it as being sustainable. And that's really interesting, because whenever you think of the idea of creating life, what is it to be alive? Within kind of, you know, when we think of life, we actually have those sort of rules, which obviously don't always apply, but they apply in general when creating a species, for example, or when there is a species. And that is that, you know, they need to eat, they need to secrete in some way, they need to be able to breed. This is school biology, so I'm sure Jules will be able to contradict me any moment now.
No, I'm pretty sure everything needs to be able to eat, breed, sleep.
Yeah, and reproduce is the other one. They, you know, they think about it in terms of reproduction. Now, so far as you can tell, I'm not sure. Maybe the creature can reproduce. Maybe the creature can't reproduce. But the context is that he creates one. He's not therefore creating a species, as it were. He's creating a single man, the perfect man. And having then created him, he runs away. Now, there's a lot to be said. There's a lot to be said about his relationship with the creature. It's certainly not fatherly. He's certainly, as I said, not created a child. He has created a man. There are a lot of parallels in terms of actually it being a metaphor for closeted homosexuality, which is, you know, being unable to kind of face up to the reality of things, even to the extent of running home, having a nervous breakdown, having an incredibly, let's not lie, his relationship with Henry Clavel, it is Clavel, isn't it? Henry Clavel, very homoerotically charged. Not least because Henry Clavel just seems to be totally unrealistic in terms of being a person. Endless, boundless patience. But also, you know, he then runs home. He then tries to marry his sort of sister, his adopted sister. It gets a bit weird. But he then tries to marry her. It occurs to me that on the night that she gets married, she dies in her wedding bed. She is killed, therefore, through that. The relationship between them is killed on the wedding bed by the manifestation of Frankenstein's homosexuality.
Yeah, it's an interesting interpretation. I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree. I think that you can absolutely read it that way, because if you're divorcing it from its sort of source material, then absolutely. And yeah. It's an interesting look at things, because clearly Frankenstein is not a well-adjusted person.
He's not well-adjusted at all. Now, I don't honestly believe that Mary Shelley had this in mind necessarily when she was writing it. But I do think that there are elements in Mary Shelley's life which mean that when she was writing it, regardless of intention or not, it lends itself to certain interpretations. And I mean, we know for a fact that she did speak about not particularly liking men, but sort of actually finding sort of solace in the arms of women, and that there might even be a letter about her literally sleeping with another woman or wanting to sleep with another woman. So there certainly seems to be a lot of evidence which suggests she was bisexual. And she was certainly keeping company with people who were less than straight.
Yeah.
And again, given the context of the time, given the idea also of, you know, the rejection, the forced rejection of certain sexuality and things like that, but not even, and it doesn't necessarily even have to be homosexuality, but the manifestation of sexuality in any form, it lends itself to this reading, which is also, weirdly enough, why I think, and this is a generalization, but it seems to me that whenever whenever I've met anyone who really, really likes the text, they're always queer. In some form or another. I'm not saying that only gay people like Frankenstein, but I am saying that anyone who I've ever met who's as passionate about it as I am has been queer in some way. That's just me, though. Anyway, so finally, I want to address my last interpretation. And I want to say that actually, this is not a text about man playing God. This is a text about man playing woman.
Okay, interesting.
What happens is that, and again, to provide some context for what was occurring during the time, around the time that Mary Shelley had, you know, started writing this, she had lost her first child, who had been born and then died very rapidly within, I think, it was within a few days, wasn't it?
Well, that she started writing it? No, it was almost a year.
No, sorry, the child, when the child was born, they died within a few days.
Yes, daughter.
Her daughter, yeah. So she had lost her first child, and then she was writing about this. And around the same time, of course, her then boyfriend, Percy Shelley, he had abandoned his wife, who then committed suicide, and had also been left with a child. She had given birth to a son before that, and then committed suicide. There were several other incidents, and of course Mary Shelley herself was the, you know, her mother too had had a relationship with another man who had then sort of turned away from her. And Mary Shelley was surrounded by these women who would have these relationships with men who would preach free love, etc., and then abandon them when they became pregnant, you know. Big one to obviously bear in mind is the fact that obviously Byron was hanging around with them at the same time as well. And he was a massive asshole. So you have this context that's playing out. Now within Frankenstein, you're first of all brought with the idea that if Frankenstein had really wanted to create another being, he could have done it the easy way. Obviously, the whole point was that he wanted to do what he at the time would have been perceived as the thing that a woman could do, and never at any point did it even occur to him that women are the ones who create life, that women create life. When he's thinking about playing God or anything like that, it's like he's completely forgotten how, you know, life is even created. He does a bastardized version of it. He does an amoral version of it, which, amoral's the wrong word, totally immoral version of it, when if he really wanted to have a child or he really wanted to create life, it would have actually been quite easy. He could have just gone ahead and married Elizabeth. And weirdly enough, in the play with Benedict Cumberbatch, and Johnny Lee Miller, they touched on that theme quite well, in that, you know, he's obsessing over it and Elizabeth is like, we can create life anytime you want, we'd literally just have to have sex, that's what it is. So in some ways he's playing woman, and then what happens is that he creates this life and he flees from it. Much like all of these men who would do the fun part, or you know, the strenuous part, they would do their part in the creation of life and then take no responsibility for it. Now, what's particularly scary about, if you take it in that context, for the male readers, is that they create life and then they have to deal with the responsibility of it, having fled away from it. And for me, that's my favourite interpretation. This is a story where, knowingly or not, Mary Shelley has reflected on the characters of the men around her, and basically, you know, call them up on the fact that they abandon the things that they create, and thus they have to deal with the consequences of it. And I do wonder if it would have even been the same horror story if Frankenstein had been a woman, and that the very particular decision to make Frankenstein a man.
I sort of follow.
Am I rambling
what
here?
You mean? I think, yeah, she's absolutely making a comment, whether obliquely or consciously or unconsciously, about, you know, the fact that men don't take responsibility for their actions. That's very apparent all the way through. And obviously, you remember, for our audience, not you, Madeline, remembers that she actually ended up writing it in the first place out because Byron challenged everybody to write a ghost story. And I think Mary Shelley and John Polidori were the only people who actually completed it, including Byron himself, who didn't complete things. So, yeah, I think maybe she was going, well, one of the most horrible things I can think of to horrify these men is facing them with the consequences of their own actions. So there could have been an element of that in there as well.
Yes.
But it...
Yeah, would you?
I mean,
look
I
at
think
that.
It says a lot about
it's the consequences
ego,
of your own actions.
At the time, and the fact that they're thoughtless, feckless, and kind of very inconsiderate of everybody else around them when they decide to do something. They consider themselves these great creators. I've got a feeling that she might have also been commenting a little bit unfavourably on the people she was hanging around with as well. It's like, you're these great creators, everybody worships you, but they don't realise that you're absolute
yes.
shit heels kind of thing. And I'm not...
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I completely agree. It's... Because it doesn't necessarily even have to be a child in so much respect, but just the idea of running away from responsibility for lauding, and this is the thing, is they laud themselves as these creators, and Frankenstein puts them, the book, not the character, Frankenstein puts that within context and basically says, actually, the creating part is the easy part, but the fact is that you don't actually really know what you've done, and you don't think about what you're doing either. You just allow it to happen and then damn the consequences. And these consequences hurt. These consequences hurt people. And you've never even thought about that, and then you're not ready for the consequences when they come bounding to your door.
I think there's also the, which would have been very much in keeping with the mindset of the time, is the idea that women have more of a natural bond with their children than men do. So
yeah.
While it's, that's why mothers who abandoned their children or smothered their children at birth were considered so unnatural. It was considered to literally go against God and man kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas by casting Frankenstein in the role of being both a mother and a father, almost a sort of parthenogenic type of procreation,
yeah,
it makes Frankenstein that much more unnatural, because he should have this bond and yet he rejects it utterly.
Yeah, he does. So yeah, it's a really interesting text, and I think part of the reason it has survived for so long is that it does have a lot there to unpack, and it does touch on these incredibly humans, you know, these human questions, these human concerns, and these, you know, these human situations of, you know, responsibility and abandonment and, you know, the fear of one's own creation, be that creation, you know, physical or internal as well, and to run away from the truth and not face up to it or to try and disguise it. These are all elements which are very strong within Frankenstein, which makes it, as far as I'm concerned, such a universal book.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to loop back to one point that I think you made earlier when you were talking about how Frankenstein hadn't created a species, and one of the things that actually pulled him up, apparently, and we're supposed to think he learns the error of his ways a little bit, is the fact that the creature requests a mate, which is obviously leads to him eventually killing Elizabeth in her wedding bed on her wedding night. And what pulls Frankenstein up is the fact that this creature might reproduce and then create a nation of a super strong monsters kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which horrifies him. And unfortunately, that is somewhere where Shelley kind of has, you know, there's a bit of a plot hole there in the sense of Frankenstein could stitch murderers and thieves and things together and create the optimum man who turns out to not be very optimum in Frankenstein's eyes. But he couldn't conceive of creating a creature that, a mate for the creature, to keep it happy that is not capable of giving birth, you know, which would actually be quite a relatively easy thing to do.
Yes.
By comparison.
Well, yeah. He thought, you can bring someone to life, you could probably just, you know.
Do a hysterectomy, you know.
Do a hysterectomy, or, you know, just not include certain parts when you're building your.
Yep, there is that.
It would have been really easy.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you've said, and as I will go on to explain when I go on to Dracula in a moment, context is really important. The context and the mindset of the time, which was just sort of pre-Victorian, the idea that, I mean, they were actually fairly open about sex and things, even though you weren't supposed to be openly wanting it if you were female. You certainly weren't supposed to be openly wanting it outside of marriage. Mm. Which is where Mary Wollstonecraft and obviously Mary Shelley later, you know, sort of came a cropper in polite society. Well, the polite society of the time. And, you know, it's definitely a theme in Frankenstein. It's really noticeable by its absence. Sometimes the fact that something is missing makes it as significant. And the absence of normal sexual reproduction throughout Frankenstein is really, really conspicuous by its absence.
Yeah. Very, very conspicuous by its absence.
So, yeah, replaced by this sort of monstrous way of procreating.
Yeah.
Okay, so, since we're looking at context and things of the time, I mean, and this includes publishing as well, when I go on to talk about Dracula, is the fact that sometimes you write a book and the publishers go, yes, we want that, but. And behind the but comes a list of things that you can't include for whatever reason. And then later on, you as an author cop it in the neck because people would have rather that had been in there, even though, and you've probably signed contracts to the effect of, yes, but I wasn't allowed to include that because, and you can't tell anyone. But we know that still happens today, okay? So it was interesting to look at publishing during the Victorian era. So let's look at Dracula. Mm-hmm. Most people have got a rough idea of, you know, the basic story of Dracula. You know, it's told in epistolary form. Jonathan Harker goes over to Transylvania to help a lonely count in his crumbling castle purchase land in London. The count turns out to be a blood-drinking fiend who is after Jonathan Harker's fiancée. Except that is not how Bram Stoker originally wrote the book. Dracula had over 100 pages cut out of it before the publishers would agree to actually publish it. And during the Victorian era, you sold publishing rights to individual countries. So Bram Stoker sold the rights to Dracula in London, and therefore that would include sort of the UK. And then he sold them separately again to a publisher in America, and again to Germany and Sweden and Iceland and a few other places. What's really interesting is that because Icelandic isn't actually a very widely spoken language in the same way English is, nobody noticed that there was massive, massive differences between Dracula, the English version of the story, and Mactmyrkrana, which is the Icelandic translation of the story.
Yeah.
So let's take a little look at those differences because it's really, really interesting. We've talked about the basic plot of Dracula. The basic plot of Mactmyrkrana follows the same thing. Now, it's not Jonathan Harker in Mactmyrkrana. Mactmyrkrana, by the way, means powers of darkness. So I'm going to call it powers of darkness now so I don't have to keep butchering the Icelandic because obviously I don't speak it. In Powers of Darkness, it's Thomas Harker, and I think that was chosen because of the Icelandic alphabet, and it was an easier foreign name for people to read, basically. Yeah. The book was sold in a serialized form in an Icelandic periodical. And, you know, there's been some contention about whether the translator just went completely happy-go-lucky and lost his head and just started hacking things about and changing things willy-nilly because, yeah, it's a great story, but I can make it this much better. Or whether he is actually doing it with Bram Stoker's consent. Now, the things that are different, you've got Thomas Harker going off to Transylvania. That part of the book is huge. It actually takes up more than half of the book if you read Powers of Darkness. And the horror, the creeping horror of everything that happens there, Thomas Harker sort of holds on to his belief a lot longer, even though he knows there's something very wrong with the Count. The Count, by the way, is seriously mellowed in Dracula. In Powers of Darkness, he's this horrible, racist, totalitarian bigot who believes he belongs on top and that the way you rule is by might. His reasons for buying land in London have nothing to do with Mina Murray, or Harker as she becomes. Absolutely nothing to do with her at all. He wants to go to London because at that point in time, London was the centre of the world. And from London is the best place to launch basically a world domination scheme, and he was really up for that. The castle isn't exactly empty either. There, instead of, you know, you've got the two sisters and the mother who Dracula has at some point turned into vampires who then torment Jonathan Harker. Thomas Harker is haunted by this beautiful, exquisite blonde woman who keeps calling to him. It's really graphically very sexual, even though nothing actually happens on page. But you've got Thomas Harker wandering around with massive erections for half the book.
Fair enough.
Which is, you know, the Icelandic audience was more comfortable with that sort of sexual content, whereas you could not refer to that in Victorian London. So that obviously got chopped. And in the basement of the castle, or the catacombs, whatever you want to call it, there's this entire priesthood worshipping this sort of primordial blood-drinking deity that, again, doesn't really have very much to do with Dracula. He's just there. And Thomas Harker's kind of like, maybe I can get out of the castle this way, and walks into the middle of this ceremony, realises that there's human sacrifice going on, and is absolutely horrified. Escapes back to his room where he's tormented by the blonde vampire again. It's really, really interesting. Unfortunately, because it was serialised, I think it sort of went on in this manner for a year or so. And the publishers of that periodical went, no, 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 you've got to wrap up the story now. And the second half of the book, it's like reading the outline. As in, Mina goes here and does this, Lucy dies, etc. There's this, the whole second half of the book, which would have been huge and sprawling, is set in, you know, London and Whitby, etc., everywhere you'd expect for Dracula. And it's just sort of there's a fortune teller who pairs up with Dracula and helps start the rumours that, you know, begin his ascent to world domination and things. It's mad. Dr. Seward dies as well, gets murdered in London.
Yay!
And there's, you know, the big hunt across Transylvania, and actually think just gets sort of wrapped up in about six pages. It's really interesting that Mina is a much more dynamic character in Powers of Darkness, as in when she doesn't hear from Jonathan, she goes, she hires guides and things to take her across Europe to Transylvania. In order to go looking for him, to look for any clue of what's happened to her fiancé. And by sheer chance, she chances upon the nunnery where Thomas Harker is. And he's lost his memory. But when she goes to him, he recovers his memory and then marries him. There's no romance, really, between Mina and the Count. So there's lots and lots of differences. I actually recommend people give Matt McCrana a try. The second half of it will irritate you because it is basically an outline.
Yeah.
But it would make a really, really... If someone decided to remake Dracula, but make it as Powers of Darkness, it would make a really interesting film. So the question is, did the translator just go a bit sort of go a bit overboard? Didn't just translate the English, but went, no, just make a better story.
No one can stop me.
Well, they turned up one of Bram Stoker's original manuscripts at an auction in America, and it turned out that it included a lot of these plot points and things that turn up in Powers of Darkness. So it looks as though the original story was supposed to be Powers of Darkness. And then when he presented it to his London publishers, they went, you can't have all this sex and violence. We need you to do something about this. We can't publish this. We'll get sued.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
So you ended up with a completely different story, which unfortunately has been subject to a lot of misinterpretation. Bram Stoker, unfortunately, never really saw a lot of money from Dracula, which is ironic considering it became one of the most iconic vampire stories of all time. Yeah. And people have since made millions of it. Ever since the first film started coming out, and, you know, Stoker's descendants tried to sort of sue and claim the rights, but because Stoker hadn't actually registered the copyright properly in America, basically it was open to anyone to do what they wanted with it. It was in the public domain from the beginning. And yeah, they made loads and loads of money, and they made all the films. You have Nosferatu. I mean, basically all those films come from Dracula. And at some point, the Count got confused with Vlad Tepish, Vlad the Impaler, when in fact Stoker, as you can tell from his notes from his early manuscripts, and Stoker wrote, I mean, I scribble things on bits of paper when I'm writing. And, you know, I have a spreadsheet with what was happening in my story. And anyone who decided to try and reconstruct my work from notes, assuming my work got destroyed, would be really disappointed because I don't have much detail. Stoker's got, like, thousands and thousands of pages of what happens when. It's, you know, it's quite a satisfying read in its own right. A bit like Tolkien as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like he and Tolkien would have a ball together.
Yeah, basically. So, It just seems that it was this story, Powers of Darkness, that got seriously censored by the publishers and then lost for 100 years or more. And then when someone said, oh, you know what I think I'm going to do? I'm going to take Powers of Darkness, the Icelandic version of Dracula, and retranslate it back into English. And it's a different story. It's the same story, but it's completely different what happens.
It's just mind-boggling and so cool at the same time.
It's really interesting. But, yeah, Dracula, the character, the Count, didn't have anything to do with Vlad Tepish. Bram Stoker was actually writing about a creature that was thousands of years old, is the idea. Yeah. And if you want more information on this, you can check out Dracul by Dacre Stoker, which is, again, a fictionalised account of Bram Stoker's life as a child, because there's some very strange events in his childhood and things which make a delicious appendix to this entire situation. And he's got copious notes and things because he inherited the manuscripts and the notes, etc. So
yeah,
it's very, very interesting.
That is very cool. Thank you.
I will say I don't entirely buy... Honestly, the skeptic in me says that this was a marketing ploy. So Dacre Stoker and his team have said, no, Bram Stoker was writing about this thousands of year old being because he wanted to warn people because he is real. And if you look at his notes from a certain perspective, yes, it certainly looks like that. On the other hand, if you want to sell a book, then you take something like Dracula and then you write the story of the author and then you say, oh, by the way, there's all these notes that support this conclusion, and that is like the best marketing technique ever. So,
yeah. Cool idea, though.
Very cool idea. Very cool idea. So, yeah, while I'm not offering different interpretations of Dracula, and we've scarcely got time for them anyway, it is very interesting to consider the context, just as we did with Frankenstein, because the context of publishing Dracula in Victorian England was that it would sell if it was a more sentimental story about a love that crossed the oceans of time kind of thing. Not that it was about this complete megalomaniac who wanted to rule the world.
Yeah. I think also the other thing was that, you know, you had to be very careful about writing an invasion story during a time where, you know, England was invading everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It would have been a little bit awkward.
Yeah. And yet still on the minds of people. Because I think you still get, you get a shadow of it, because as you say, it, I think it was so intrinsic within, you know, the Dracula story, that even in trying to remove it, you can't remove the essence of that entirely.
Definitely not. I mean, some of this is Hollywood. It's the Hollywood sort of Vaseline on the lens, rosy gaze, making Dracula this debonair, sexy sort of predator. He's not really especially sexy in Dracula, and he's definitely not sexy at all in Powers of Darkness. He is this terrible sorcerer type character
who
is not appealing in that way at all. Genuine predator on every single level.
On another level, it's quite interesting, because I think that Stoker's Irish background also played a little bit into that, certainly in terms of the way that the supernatural was viewed.
Yeah, definitely. He allows a certain credulity into his writing that you don't really see from people. In fact, there were other writers not even writing in a similar fashion. They were framing it as science rather than a genuine brush with the supernatural.
Yeah. Certainly, so, the idea of the supernatural as a terrible force, but also the idea of the supernatural actually being this terrible force that wasn't necessarily charismatic, or was charismatic but in a way that feels violent or frightening as well. And the idea of something definitely ancient, the ancient world coming back for you, rather than, you know, the modern world taking precedence, but the ancient world winning out. Well, not necessarily winning, because obviously it doesn't, but the ancient world rising back up again.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of what we're getting at with talking about first Frankenstein and then Dracula, and a few more in a moment, is the fact that, yes, the context of the time definitely matters, and you can read a book on its shallowest level and just read it as you would read it now and sort of decide how you interpret it, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But half the time, you're not necessarily even reading what was written. That's the problem. Because there was, you know, people didn't have digital files of books and things. There weren't very many copies. There, you know, books that were submitted to publishers were submitted in handwriting. They were long written. So
yeah,
getting hold of an original manuscript, for example, the original two or three manuscripts for The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte, do not exist anymore because Charlotte Bronte burnt them after her sister's death. The reason for this is that The Tenant of Wildfell Hall was a highly controversial book at the time. It was tipped to probably sell better than the others by the other Bronte sisters. So there may have been a little bit of sort of competition going on there for Charlotte. Charlotte, the last Bronte sibling left alive at that point in time. But it may also have been that Charlotte was very carefully managing her image. I mean, she, you know, her star was rising when she died, and she died at the age of 37.
Yeah.
Anne Bronte died age 30. She was a little bit younger. And Anne Bronte's books do not have the same gothic bend that Emily and Charlotte's do. Her books are concerned very much with a rigorous questioning of Christian faith, because she believed that doubt was a cornerstone of her robust faith, and also with social issues at the time. Agnes Grey, for example, takes down the sort of rich society that treats governesses like slaves a peg or two, and there's evidence that it may have actually influenced those sort of families who read it and took it on board. The Tenant of Wildfell Hall was an amazingly feminist piece of writing before the idea of feminism was even really out there. It's all about the Women's Property Act and the fact that, you know, as a woman, once you are married, your husband could theoretically put you out of the house, keep all your property, keep any of the children, and you'd have no rights. He could put you to live on the street, which is why marriage contracts had to be so carefully written so that you got a certain amount of allowance given to you from your own money as well.
Yeah.
It's just you wouldn't have control of it. In The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, the main character, Helen, finds that she's married a really abusive man. He's violent, he's drunk, he runs through money like nobody's business. He has friends around for months at a time, and they're indulging in all sorts of things. He has an affair while she's in the house with another woman, and she actually contemplates having a retaliatory affair with another man who is, you know, this woman's husband. She doesn't do it, but the fact that Anne Bronte put that on the page was scandalous at the time.
Yeah.
And it was just... It was just an incredibly brave piece of writing. The fact that Helen, once her son starts to become like his father, starts to show some of his... She believes that his father is being a bad influence on him as a five-year-old. And since his father is getting him to drink wine and whiskey and things at 5 years old, then yes, he probably is.
Yeah, that's not a good father thing to do.
So she escapes. She escapes with the clothes on her back, one servant, and, you know, her art materials. And goes into hiding with her son. She would stay if it was just her, but she's not going to leave her son to be raised by this man who is an abuser, a rapist, and a bully.
Yeah.
I mean, the book sold really, really well, but Charlotte sort of apologised to everybody after Anne died and said, you know, Anne was very young, she didn't really know what she was saying. It was kind of a big betrayal, but again, Charlotte was managing her image and didn't really want to be linked with this sort of scandal. Whereas Anne was kind of like, no, this stuff needs to be said, I believe it.
Yeah.
And now you cannot read Tenant of Wildfell Hall as it was originally written because Charlotte had it re-edited and she did a lot of the editing and cut things out. So it's been reconstructed. If you ever read it, read the one with notes by, basically the Penguin version, because it's got the notes by Stevie somebody or other who has actually reconstructed it as best as possible.
That's really interesting. I did not know that at all. That is I actually feel really bad. I feel like that's like such an immense betrayal.
Yeah, I don't think it was entirely spiteful either. It was just a case of they held very different political opinions. Charlotte was a lifelong Tory. Anne was not. Anne was more liberal.
Well, there you go.
So I think it's interesting. It's the original manuscripts of things are really important, I think, for these sort of works, because I remember reading The Tenant of Wildfell Hall when I was 14 and thinking, yeah, it was okay. And then I reread it again as an adult and I made sure I got the proper version with the notes and everything that had been reframed with the framing narrative. And I sort of thought, my God, I've read a completely different book.
Yeah. It also makes me think, it's not so much the same, but it's like anyone who ever says, well, any of Frankenstein is pretentiously written. All of the pretentious elements are all Percy Shelley's fault.
Yeah, never let your husband edit your book. Well, actually, I mean, maybe your husband's an editor or something, but basically that's what happened. Frankenstein got reissued, didn't it, two or three times. And each time Percy Shelley sort of chopped a little bit more off.
Yeah, chopped a little bit more off, changed certain little bits and bobs. And, you know, you do have to ask, you do have to wonder, actually, what of the original manuscript by 16-year-old Mary Shelley? What was taken out? Do we know? Do we know what might have been removed, what might have been added, how things might have been changed by the smallest, you know, word change even? We don't know, and that will forever frustrate me.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same with, you know, things like the Tenant of Wildfell Hall. So, I mean, you can say this probably about most of the 19th century classics. I mean, they're classics by dint of the fact they contain themes that have made them survive. At the time, they were simply novels, and most of them were considered kind of trash.
Mm.
Which is, you know, the attitude on genre fiction.
Ah, yes.
So, yeah, you know, anything that was for the populist or the populist vote was kind of considered unimportant intellectually.
Yeah.
And yet they've survived, where you have to really dig to find the books of essays and things
that were considered, you know, the bee's knees at the time.
Yes, tell a good story.
Tell a good story. And, yeah, tell a story which actually is relevant to people. I think that's the other thing.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of Charlotte Bronte, I just want to talk about, you know what, I actually kind of really want to draw this as a cartoon. Charlotte Bronte versus Jane Austen. which is ridiculous because, you know, there are different eras, generations apart, writing different audiences. But until her publisher actually sent her copies of Jane Austen's books, Charlotte had never read them. Charlotte, being a quintessential Tory woman, despite being, you know, of Irish descent, her father was Irish, she spoke with an Irish accent for most of her life. And yet she was very, very down on the Irish and considered them sort of low-born people who weren't very intelligent, which is why, you know, she sort of disdained Arthur Bell Nichols for so long. Is the fact that, you know, it's kind of the Margaret Thatcher thing. People say Margaret Thatcher did great things for women, when what she really did was great things for Margaret Thatcher. Charlotte Bronte was a very sort of like, yes, women can do things, or rather, I can do things and I happen to be a woman. She wasn't really doing great things for women. She had a great many female friends who were great writers and things.
Yeah.
And yet she wanted very much to identify as a woman within the confines of a Victorian marriage. She wanted a man to dominate her as well.
Yeah.
So, yes, I want to be lauded for my genius and my intelligence, but at the same time, I also want this. So how you manage to get those two things to line up is already difficult if for you as a person, kind of thing. So she read Jane Austen, and it seems to have completely gone over her head. Charlotte Bronte is clearly a genius writer, but it completely escaped her. It went right over her head. She said that Jane Austen knew nothing about the human heart, because Jane Austen wrote this tight, controlled prose that was so multi-layered that Charlotte didn't see that there were even any layers. Which I find fascinating in some respects, because, you know, Charlotte Bronte's, it's all there on the page. It's all splurged out. Everything from the sort of opium waking dream of Villette to the protestations of love from Jane Eyre.
Yeah. I also think that the other problem was that Charlotte Bronte loved in a very particularly toxic way.
Potentially, yes. I mean, I think I've touched on this before, but Branwell, her brother, was the same. I mean, there's no evidence that he did actually have an affair with a married woman. It looks like he might have just been a fantasist.
Yeah.
And there's no evidence that Charlotte's affections for what's his name? Her professor.
Yeah.
It's gone out of my head. It'll come back. But there's no evidence that that was ever returned. I mean, yeah. I'm wondering if maybe he was just one of those men who was a little bit flirty in how he talked to people, but never actually encouraged her. He was clearly very much together with his wife and, you know, didn't return Charlotte's letters or anything. So it seems to have all, again, been entirely in her head.
Yeah. But so. she did become very obsessive, I think.
Yeah, she became obsessive in the same way, again, as her brother did. I mean, my theory is that, I mean, we think that Branwell had a form of epilepsy, and I genuinely believe that's true, and I think that's also how he got hooked on laudanum. because there wasn't very much you could do with epilepsy back then, except sort of try and control the pain aspects of it or lock them up in an asylum, which is what people did. If you had something like I've got, which is temporal lobe epilepsy, it can make you very, very weird. I think Charlotte may have suffered a similar thing, but in a milder form, and just it wasn't diagnosed as epilepsy.
Yeah.
And it, you know, the depression, the migraines, the not being able to sleep, the chronic pain, the sense of reality not really being something you can trust, that's all there for both of them. So yeah. I'm wondering if that didn't feed into it. But you're right. They both had those intense sort of passionate love affairs for people who could not, would not, and did not love them back.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, it, I think that there is that in that comes into play. And you, I know it sounds really obvious, but one thing that you do need to remember whenever you are reading any kind of, you know, novel of any particular period, is that it will reflect the very personal beliefs and feelings and interpretations of the world from a very particular person. It's not going to be a whole wide world reflection of everybody in that era.
No, definitely not. Even if you're trying to write something from which you remove your own judgment and perspective as much as possible, it will still go in there.
Yeah, it's impossible to separate anything which is coming from your mind, because any thought that you've had has come through the filter of your experiences.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's a common mistake for people to confuse authors with their best known and best loved characters. This happened to Charlotte herself, where she was actually introduced at a party that William Thackeray was holding. As here is Jane Eyre, and Charlotte was nothing like Jane Eyre at all, other than being very shy in company.
Yeah. Now that's a bit odd. It's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I think the thing was, people expected her to be very witty and verbose and talkative and entertaining in person, because of how she wrote, because that is how she wrote. Whereas if you put her in a party full of people, she just clammed up and was really shy and incredibly conscious of the fact that she wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you put Jane Austen in company with people, she was actually genuinely witty and also quite catty. So
yes, catty, absolutely.
Yeah. I think that the difficulty Jane Austen probably suffered from, and I do have some sympathy, was that most of the time she was the most intelligent person in the room, and very few people could actually match her, and she got bored. And I, yeah. You know, I get that. I do really understand.
Yeah. So yeah, essentially our conclusion from all this is that, context does change things, and the periods of the time will have definitely affected the way that these novels were written, knowingly or not. Certainly in the case of Dracula, there was a very conscious decision there. In the case of Frankenstein, there may have been some conscious or some subconscious decisions which were affecting that. The most frustrating thing is that we will never completely know, because these are novels which have gone through adaptation after adaptation and, you know, have gone through an entire process. We will never get to see the original texts themselves. So it is very interesting. I get super fascinated by it all.
Definitely. I think the question to leave you with is, you've picked up a 19th century classic. Is it in fact the book you think you're reading? Find out.
Yeah. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you have one for us.
I have, and it couldn't be more divorced from our subject matter today. I've been watching The Lower Decks, which is an animated Star Trek spin-off, which you can find on Amazon Prime. this is really, really good. If particularly for anyone who is a Star Trek fan, you know how in The Next Generation, all the good characters leave the ship on an away mission, and you think, well, I guess Ensign Dave from Deck 5 is in charge of the Enterprise again, whoever Ensign Dave is. This is kind of from the Ensign Dave's perspective. It's the crew that do the grunt work on the lower decks, and what it's like to be the non-star players on an all-star football team kind of thing. It's really, really funny. It's very intelligently done. And it points out the flaws in Star Trek. Much as I love it, it points out the flaws in having all these great A-lister characters who then just disappear off and do things, and the fact that they make these dramatic decisions that affect hundreds of people on the ship that you never get to see. And what those people feel about things.
Is it actually set on any particular ship with any particular crew? Or
it's set on the USS Cerritos, which is like... it's an old class style, not a bit like the Enterprise. It's obviously not the Enterprise. They talk about the Enterprise a lot because the Enterprise is the famous ship that does all that weird stuff.
Right.
And it's set sort of towards the end of The Next Generation, I think, roughly. So we're not quite in Deep Space Nine territory, but we're not sort of during the same time as the Enterprise doing all its stuff as well.
Right. Got it. I'm definitely going to have to check that out then. I've heard that there are a few little Easter eggs in there as well, which I do love me a good Easter egg. On that note, guys, we will say thank you so much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this. Do get in contact with us. Let us know what you think. Do you have any interpretations of Dracula or Frankenstein or the Tenant of, what was it?
Tenant of Wildfell Hall.
Wildfell Hall. I almost keep saying the Tenant of Wolf Hall, and I was like, no, I'm mixing books up there completely. Hilary Mantel has just come swinging in the room. Do let us know what you think, or whether what we've said has changed your opinions of them. Remember, you can get in touch with us by Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter, both individually or through our Dissecting Dragons page. For now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.